So what we're going to do, what I'm going to do tonight, is to carry on with the theme that we've been working on, looking at this map. And I thought before we kind of go into it, I'd just like to clarify an issue that I think might be useful, which is that looking at the wheel of life, it tends to give rise to sort of the language of a path, of a kind of progression from one place to another. And that can be useful, and it's one way of describing Buddhist practice. And there is also another way of describing practice, which is that of the lotus, the kind of unfoldment of experience. And I think it's important to understand that just that this is an image, the images of Buddhist practice, these descriptions of paths, lotus, are also simply images. So to not grip too tightly to either kind of mode or either sort of sense of how, or the sort of descriptions, the narrative around practice. What we're really looking to do in communication of the Dharma is actually to point you in the direction of a direct experience, an experience that you can actually feel and know in yourself. And trying to kind of hold those experiences in particular shapes can sometimes get us into more difficulties than benefits. So what I'm encouraging you to do is certainly when we're looking at these sort of images and working with the Buddhist ideas, it's good to hold them as lightly as possible. And actually just try to connect them, take time for them to soak into our experience, to kind of, not to kind of grasp after them. Sometimes it's described as that the Dharma isn't taught as much as caught. And there's that sense of, you just kind of get a flavour of something, which you can then just hold lightly. If you kind of grip onto it, literalise the teaching, what tends to happen is that you, in effect, kill the teaching, because it hasn't got, you've kind of strangled the life out of it. So just, whatever I'm saying tonight, as far as possible, hold it lightly is what I'm suggesting. So, I think the main thing I'd like to carry on emphasising is that I think the kind of central core of practice is simply noticing the extent to which we are gripping or releasing within our current experience. And to know that if we find ourselves having that sense of gripping, holding something, we are probably becoming identified with a particular view, a particular experience. We're trying to kind of maintain a particular position in the flow and the kind of constant unfolding of reality. And that sense of gripping is the problem. It's this sense of gripping that is recreating a sense, or attempting to create a sense of separate being. That's trying to recreate an identity which will need maintaining and protecting. So it's the gripping onto experience that is the problem, not the content of arising experience. And so this is why on the wheel we have this sense of a sort of a bounded field of experience. And it's this edge between this construct of a separate selfhood and life, the world, that is the edge that we're kind of interested in and trying to bring curiosity to. So what we're saying in practice is really asking us to explore what is here, what is actually in our experience, and be curious about that, and also be curious about what we're doing with that experience. What are we adding to it, and what are we taking away from experience? So just quick recap. In the heart of the image, we have the kind of core activities that create this sense of separation, or attempt to recreate this sense of separation. So we have the pushing and pulling at bare experience. So we talk about this as greed and hatred, but more, it just becomes more and more subtle, but all that basically that means, what that's referring to, is this tendency to either move away from actual experience or try to get hold of it. So this is the sort of core activity that is perpetuating this whole flow, this whole movement, this whole illusion, driving this whole illusion of a separate selfhood. And then what I talked about last week was in this second rim, there's an illustration which is pointing to the workings of karma. So this is the slower, sort of less visible rhythms of that movement, that kind of pushing and pulling of experience, which is arising out of the depths of what we described last week as this the storehouse consciousness. And all this is what it's pointing towards is that it's showing this movement from these sort of bare responses that begin to become habits, which are creating kind of the intentions at the sort of deeper level of our life, and gradually that begins to concretize, coalesce into habits of response, habits of seeing, habits of knowing. And this brings us to this third level, the third aspect of the image. So what I'm going to be talking about tonight is seeing how the habits create our worldview. So the seeds of our previous responses to bare experience, they blossom into the perception now of how things are. So what I'm trying to communicate with you tonight is that I'd really like you to know that there is no objective world. So each of us in this room is knowing this universe in a completely unique way. So here I am, I imagine, trying to communicate to you, and I'm using words and phrases, and they carry particular intonation, and internally they carry particular significance or weight for me. And I'm in this body, dressed in this way, and energetically sort of being present to you in a very particular way. But how you read, how you receive my words, my movement, my energy, is utterly, completely unique to you. So which words you pick up on, the way you receive what I'm trying to communicate, would all be specific to you. Because all this, all our sensory experience is being filtered and interpreted through the ongoing blossoming of these seeds of your and my past experience. So it's quite a, I guess what I'm describing is quite a complex web of separate universes, which are kind of interlocking, interweaving in this space. So this is really what this this section here is attempting to describe in some way. So these sections are called referred to as the six realms. Now, really, don't take it literally. This is just as if it's a snapshot, really, or a map of a particular way of describing territory. Because in this, in the wheel or on the wheel, there are as many different worlds as there are deluded beings, as there are people sensing that they have some separate being. So each of us here have our own sort of unique place in these realms. So we're all creating our own world through our interpretation, our filtering of our experience, to recreate the known and to avoid the unexpected. So this is what we're doing constantly. We're trying to make the universe known and safe, and we are filtering experience most of the time to try to get it to fit our worldview of how things actually are for us. So we tend to only allow in those experiences that will confirm the identity that we've created. And this is why, unfortunately, other people are so challenging. Because what happens is that they tend not to be and act and respond as they should. Because they happen to inhabit a completely different universe. And it's this meeting of universes which really begin to challenge our constructs. And this is one of the great pains and delights of Sangha, that it actually begins to soften and release us from this kind of quite fixed sense of a separateness, of kind of holding a particular position, creating a particular universe. Okay, so up until now I've been describing the Wheel of Life as a map. But tonight I think it would be useful to begin to describe it as a mirror. And I say that because by kind of reflecting on the image, by sitting with the image, what it may do is help us see ourselves, and specifically the kind of the qualities of the world that we are recreating through our views, through our responsiveness, moment by moment. So I'm going to be what I'm going to be doing tonight is just unpacking these six different realms as described on the image, hoping that you might get a sense of the realms that are particular or familiar to you. So I'm going to begin at the top, this section here. And this is described as the God realm, or the Deva realm. And the beings in this realm, they seem to have found themselves here as if they've arisen out of, spontaneously out of a beautiful lotus flower. So their experience of being in life tends to be very pain-free. They find themselves in great states of comfort and ease, and they seem mainly preoccupied with maintaining these states. So the God realm, the Deva realm, they become very identified with the sustaining of ongoing pleasure, bliss, wealth and status. And the gods have become bound by the need to perpetually feel happy, healthy, expansive, and loving. So this is the God realm. And unfortunately, the gods, they tend to, as a consequence of being so identified and needing to create this universe of ongoing pleasure and bliss, they tend to banish anything from their universe that contradicts these feelings and experiences. So there's a kind of a narcissistic approach to life. And they definitely disidentify with experiences which aren't bright, happy, wealthy, and describe them as being in some way dysfunctional. So one of the difficulties of being in the God realm, the Deva realm, is that the inhabitants forget that health, wealth, status, and expansive mental states are all conditioned and subject to change. And it's the over-identification with these ephemeral states that lead to a great sense of loss, of confusion and doubt when these conditions are no longer present. So this is the God realm. It's kind of incredibly pleasurable, blissful. But the consequences as we begin to drop out of these experiences is actually incredibly painful. The loss is huge. So these states, we are kind of moving in and out of them, moving through them, depending on our views and our judgments, our kind of constructs, our fabrications. And we'll just tend to sort of move from place to place, realm to realm, dependent on our own sort of mental states. But fortunately, what we have in the image, and it's rather crucial to the whole kind of resource, the whole kind of basis of practice, is that looking down or kind of engaging with us in this this sense of separate selfhood, is that we have the figure of the Buddha, and specifically Avalokiteshvara. So Avalokiteshvara is the kind of manifestation of a compassionate activity arising out of the wisdom of the Buddha, or the wisdom of the Buddha. So I think this is the Buddha on this side and Avalokiteshvara. So the presence of these forces in the universe are absolutely crucial for us to do anything apart from just endlessly spiral, endlessly circle on the wheel. So in each realm that is pictured, what we find in each of the picture, each of the realms, is a manifestation of Avalokiteshvara. And this is absolutely crucial, as I say, to actually begin the process of unhooking, unbinding, freeing ourselves from any particular self-created universe. So the presence of this compassionate activity coming into our experience is actually, in a way, the kind of without that, we would be perpetually locked and confused and lost. So what good fortune that we have this these beneficent forces coming into the world, this kind of willing us towards reality. This is why we have the shrine, of course. It's kind of is directly linking us or acknowledging that there is this presence, this aspect to life, which is greater than our self-created, constructed perception of life. So Avalokiteshvara in the God realm does something unique. So compassion has to be responsive to the specifics of the situation. So in the God realm, in the Deva realm, what Avalokiteshvara does is play an instrument, the lyre, and plays the music of impermanence. So Avalokiteshvara in the realm of the gods is reminding the gods that everything arises and passes in dependence on conditions. Everything is impermanent. And I was actually reading about this morning, and I found something really, what I thought was lovely, is that actually also Avalokiteshvara is playing this music, but then stops. And that stopping of the music is the thing that actually alerts the gods that they've been hearing the music. And then the music continues. But it's actually that silence, that noticing the silence, the gap in the music, that creates in the gods curiosity. and out of the curiosity there's a possibility of wonder. So what it seems to be saying is that it's the wonder that breaks the narcissism of the gods. They're able to access or see beyond their constructs, see beyond themselves, beyond their conditioning, and step back into relationship to the reconnecting wonder of being alive. So this is the music of Avalokiteshvara, the music that plays the songs of impermanence, but also the music arising out of the silence, giving rise to wonder. So that's the God poem. We're now going to move down to here. Perhaps I should say, as I go round, it might be useful just for you to notice if any of you, you know, if you're aware of any of these realms in your own experience. You'll probably have kind of flavours or kind of hints of all of the realms in yourself at some point. But just to bear that in mind as I talk. So we're now going into what's called the Asura realm, or the Titan realm. And this realm is primarily consumed by jealousy. And the Asuras are particularly jealous of the gods. So what we have here is actually a tree that grows out of the Asura realm. So its roots are in the Asura realm, but unfortunately, this beautiful tree with all this fruit, the fruits of this tree that gives kind of the fruits when they're eaten, kind of all wishes come true. They're kind of wish fulfilling fruits, but they land in the God realm. No wonder they're jealous. So this is what happens. For the Asuras, they can see these fruits that they long for, and they can see that they're actually dropping outside of their reach, or they appear to be out of their reach. So one of the things for the Asuras is that they're endlessly trying to prove that they are worthy of these fruits. So they're trying. The Asuras tend to strive to avoid criticism and have a huge fear of failure. And they are often prey to doubt and unfounded shame. So the Asuras have this kind of real striving, driving their lives. And behind it, or alongside that striving, they're always looking out for the attack. And they're really suspicious of cooperation and even friendship, as it could be the means of someone else to undermine their own hard-won power or knowledge. So this is quite a painful realm of kind of conflict, defensiveness, trying to either see where they are in relation to other people. So Asuras are very prone to judgment. So they're gauging, are they superior or inferior or equal to others? So there's this endless comparison and polarisation, and also being driven, unfortunately, by some fantasy of perfection, that one day they will get it right, one day those fruits will drop into their lap. So these are the driving forces of the Asura realm. And in this realm, Avalokiteshvara brings into this realm the sword of wisdom. So wisdom cuts through this struggle for perfection and actually provides the means to achieve skillful states of being. Achieve the fruits through practice that the Asuras are craving. So there's a sense of Avalokiteshvara brings a release from anxiety and a struggle through being open to the wisdom that manifests in patience, equanimity, and real faith in the conditions arising out of practice. So this is the ashram realm. Coming down next one, we find ourselves in the animal realm. So the animal realm here. So the beings in this realm, they are barking and biting to protect their turf and get to kind of carve out their territory, be left alone on their territory. And they may be found lying around in a stupor when sated with food or pleasure. And they're also seeking coziness and predictability. So this is the animal realm that some of us may recognise. And others in the animal realm, if you look at the animal kingdom, some animals tend to remain alone. So they wander in the wilderness because of the anxiety or the unpredictability of relationship. So the beings in this realm tend to identify or create a lot of anxiety around possible vulnerability, the threat of attack, whilst others seem completely oblivious to the outside world, outside of their immediate realm of comfort. So one of the interesting things about this realm and the realm of looking for coziness and comfort is that it can lead us to do things in a very particular way. So comfort becomes almost a ritualistic activity. Everything has to be in its right place so that we can then relax and feel safe and comfortable. So the need to control our environment can lead us into quite a place of isolation. As we know, well, again, sort of that is one of the aspects of the animal world. We can either be kind of in a herd, or we can be very isolated. And I thought something I was reading, which I thought was interesting, that this animal realm, actually one of the things that it seems to, or can give rise to, is the fantasy of becoming a hermit. That actually simply living in a cave far away from the complexity of relationship. So just kind of thinking about this is a way of just noticing, recognising the patterns of the animal realm and how they can sort of be activated in different ways in us. And Avalokiteshvara has something very particular to offer the animal realm, and this is pictured as the book. So there's this sense of if we find ourselves sort of over-reliant on kind of structure and order and comfort, pleasure, then one of the things that we can do is bring some knowledge into that situation to create a sense of new perspectives, new values. So we have the possibility, at least, of releasing from these views that tend to kind of fix us in very particular ways. Fix us particularly around, I guess, either kind of a reliance on comfort and ease, or a kind of fear of intimacy. So Avalokiteshvara really starts to encourage us to look at the rather closed system of the animal world, and also underneath it all, the fearful nature of this realm, that it's actually a kind of holding out in some way, or a holding in. So this is the animal realm. Coming down now into a realm that is well depicted in other traditions, this is the hell realm. So in this realm, there are manifestations of the endless forms of suffering arising as a consequence of being of identifying either with anger, with frustration, with hurt, guilt, and blame. So in the hell realm, we tend to look around us and see either fellow beings tormented, or we see other beings as tormentors. And what we recognise in the hell realm, we see that some are frozen in cold hatred, whilst others are burning with the heat of anger or frustration, and others are hanging lifeless in the hold of guilt or regret. And the difficulty of this realm is that we can become identified with the wounded. So what I mean by that is that we seek meaning only in the wound. And maybe through that we become obsessed to find a way out by returning over and over again to the wound. So it's not to say that these experiences aren't going to be present. All of us at some point have been wounded. But it's how we work with that reality, how we work with any experience particularly. But I think in the hell realm, there can be a kind of getting slightly lost or over-identified with the suffering that we have experienced, or we do experience. So there may be in this realm, or there tends to be in the hell realm, there's a gripping onto blame, either towards ourselves or towards others. And this simply binds us ever deeper into suffering. And what Avalokiteshvara does in this realm is that it is pictured, is kind of carries either a hook or a noose. So when we find ourselves in these painful places, what we really need is simply some relief from that being completely identified or lost in either feeling tormented or being we are tormentors. So as Avalokiteshvara offers a letting go of the power relationship, a letting go of self-righteousness, seeing that we are always more than our wound, and finding that through meditation we can create more space around those experiences to hold them differently, and particularly to create a more kind of opening of the heart, which then allows us to be with the wounds but not lost or over-identified within them. So this is the means Avalokiteshvara brings to the hell realm. Coming round one more to the into the Preta realm. This being the beings in this realm are rather grotesque. They have pinhole mouths, very large eyes, and distended bellies. And they're always hungry. They're always trying to fill their insatiable needs. So this is the realm of addiction and the sense of never being enough. So whenever the Preta, it's said, whenever they manage to get hold of something which they think they can get near to their mouth, unfortunately it tends to transform, even as they get it to their mouth, into either fire or excrement. So there's a sense of seeking nourishment in that which can never satisfy, and the pain of trying to use sensory experience to mask or suppress a basic lack or absence in one's being. And beings in this realm tend to be driven by dreams and fantasies that they are chasing hopelessly and endlessly, trying to make things come true. But it's always seems to be in these driven fantasies that they are, that these, the wishes, the fantasies are going to come true over there, always where we are not. So the praetor returns and again to the object of addiction in the hope that this time it will be different. So there's a real sense in the praetor realm of just not learning from experience, so falling back constantly into these well-worn paths that are ever more void of real nourishment. So what Avalokiteshvara offers in this realm is the ambrosia of discriminating wisdom. So this, what this means is the ability to really see, to discriminate where true nourishment lies. So seeing that actually our kind of tendencies towards addiction, the objects of addiction, really seeing clearly that they will not give satisfaction, and having to expand, broaden our vision, our wisdom, to find the true nourishment. So the last one, the human realm. So the beings in this last realm, the human realm, they tend to use their ability to conceptualize and share their experiences in the to create culture, create society. And they're able to manipulate and control many aspects of the natural world. And they also experience the combination of sufficient pain to actually seek answers to this existential situation that they find themselves in, whilst also having a degree of freedom from that pain to reflect upon, practice, and explore experience. The human realm is primarily preoccupied with meaning and mapping. Because what we're trying to do in the human realm is seeking to end confusion and the uncomfortable state of not knowing by attaching clear meaning and significance to arising experiences. So one of the problems of the human realm is that we can be really doing the right thing, the sensible thing, whilst being completely disassociated from actual arising experience. So the human realm there's this danger of fragmenting or splitting away from direct seeing, direct knowing, and act purely out of the social or cultural views and ways of being that are acceptable. So what Avalokiteshvara brings into this realm is the begging bowl. And this is said to be the symbol of the renunciate. And it offers primarily a shift from the manipulation, the understanding, towards direct experience. So the bowl is also seen to be the symbol for the open dimension of being that can be tasted through practice, and tasted by resting in the territory of not knowing through the powerful practice of just sitting. So, what I hope I've done is just give you a very brief overview of these infinite worlds that arise out of these core drivers of resistance and craving, and crystallize our habits of being into these actual realms of being, which we experience as being right here. And I hope that we are able to sort of look at this, reflect on this as a mirror, so you can really begin to see the way that we live, exist in self-created universes. And also to kind of look out for the gifts of Avalokiteshvara to begin to lead each of us back to this ground in which we all coexist, the ground of the earth, and know directly our interconnected and conditional nature. So that is all I'm going to say on the six realms. We're at the time, but I would like just to open up very briefly into space for any questions, observations. That's good. The reason for that space is because I think it's important. I can't gauge really whether what I've said has landed with you. So if there's anything obvious that has kind of jars or doesn't fit right, this is the space that I'm offering to see if we can do something about that. But if there isn't any immediate responses in that way, I'm happy to put us into groups now and just have a bit of time to reflect together in small groups. Now, what I thought would be useful as a reflection, as a point for discussion, is do you have a tangible sense, each of you, of how your relationship to experience is the thing that creates the universe, your universe? So do you get a sense of the views, your relationship to actual experience is creating your universe? And maybe on the back of that, can you see the difference between the kind of bare experiences and what we're doing with them? So it's this relationship which I think is very interesting and hopefully useful to explore in smaller groups. So your relationship to experience being the creator of your universe. Discuss.